You made it. You're here despite late trains and children and maybe snow. You made it. So take a deep breath. Relax. He promises rest to those who are weary. This is a good place to find rest. I've said it before, I'll say it again. If Jesus promises rest, I can't take offense if people fall asleep during a sermon. Seems like the kind of thing he would enjoy. Somebody fell asleep when Paul preached. If you fall asleep when I preach, I'll take that as a compliment. I'm in good company, is all that means. We're in John chapter 1 today. Not at the beginning, though. We're at John chapter 1, verses 29 through 42, which means you do have to remember what we talked about two Sundays ago, which I know is a stretch. In the opening lines of John's gospel, we were given a vision that was large enough to hold the whole world. We heard that in the beginning was the Word, and that the Word was with God, the Word was God. We heard that all things came into being through him, that in him was life, and that life was the light of all people. We heard with a kind of stubborn hope that the light shines into the darkness, and the darkness does not overcome it. That's the promise that's been hanging in the air over these last few weeks. God's light does not remain as some sort of abstract idea. It does not remain far away. It breaks into the actual darkness of the world, into flesh and time, into crowded places, complicated lives. It comes near enough to be encountered. And now, in today's reading, that vast vision tightens down into a single moment on the edge of the Jordan, where the light is no longer described in soaring poetry. It's pointed to, it's named, it's identified in the presence of a person who is standing within arm's reach. John the Baptist is there, and John is not the light. He's already told us he's not the sinner. He's just a witness. John exists to draw attention away from himself and toward the one who is coming. His whole life is kind of a spiritual finger pointing toward the one who will be greater than he. And the remarkable thing about a witness is this: a witness does not force, and a witness does not control. A witness speaks what he has seen. A witness tells the truth as best he knows it. A witness points, and then she steps aside. A witness creates space for another person to look and to decide. God's light has entered the world, and God has sent a witness, not to coerce belief, not to win arguments, just to tell the truth, to make room for an encounter, and then step aside. The word of the Lord from the Gospel according to John chapter 1. The next day he saw Jesus coming toward him and declared, "Here is the Lamb of God who takes away the sin of the world. This is he of whom I said, 'After me comes a man who ranks ahead of me, because he was before me.' I myself did not know him, but I came baptizing with water for this reason, that he could be revealed to Israel." And John testified, "I saw the Spirit descending from heaven like a dove, and it remained on him. I myself did not know him, but the one who sent me to baptize with water said to me, 'He on whom you see the Spirit descend and remain is the one who baptizes with the Holy Spirit.' And I myself have seen and have testified that this is the chosen one." The next day, John was again standing with two of his disciples, and as he watched Jesus walk by, he exclaimed, "Look, that there is the Lamb of God." The two disciples heard him say this, and they followed Jesus. And when Jesus turned and saw them following, he said to them, "What are you looking for?" They said to him, "Rabbi," which translated means teacher, "where are you staying?" He said to them, "Come and see." They came and saw where he was staying, and they remained with him that day. It was about 4 o'clock in the afternoon when one of the two who heard John speak and followed him was Andrew, Simon Peter's brother. He first found his brother Simon and said to him, "We've found the Messiah, the Anointed." He brought Simon to Jesus, who looked at him and said, "You are Simon, son of John. You are to be called Cephas," which is translated Peter. If we're honest, the story begins with a kind of holy confusion. John says things that sound certain. Lamb of God, Son of God, Messiah. He's throwing titles around faster than you can count. But the first disciples, they don't really understand what any of those titles will mean. They know the words, but they lack the understanding of what any of it actually means. There's lots of expectations for what a Messiah is and isn't. They know what a lamb is. They know what the Son of God metaphor is in the book of Daniel. They understand here what these things are, but there's just no way they could possibly wrap their heads around what it's actually going to turn out to look like. They don't have the right doctrine of atonement. They don't have a developed Christology. They don't know the shape of the cross or the reality of resurrection. They just don't know where the story is going. In fact, the gospel itself makes a point of that. John testifies, "I myself don't know him." He says it twice. Weird thing for a cousin to say about another cousin. They grew up together, John and Jesus. They were close. Their mothers were close. John knows Jesus, but he says twice, I don't know him. If John doesn't know him, if even John, who is called to be the witness, speaks to the rest of the crowd and says, "I don't even understand him," if he speaks as one who needs revelation, then what in the world do these other guys think? What could they possibly know? John didn't arrive with perfect clarity. He was just given a sign. He saw the Spirit descend and remain. He was allowed to recognize what he could never have recognized on his own. And that matters, because it tells us something about how faith begins. Faith does not begin with mastery. It does not begin with having the right categories or a tidy explanation. It begins with being drawn towards something that you still can't fully name yet. And the two disciples who are standing with John are the poster children of that look, of being drawn into something that they just don't understand. For you teachers in the room, you know this student or group of students, those who are classically trained and always looking like they just will never understand what's going on. That's the first two disciples. That's where we start, is with that group of people. There's no pretense about it. They have no idea what's going on, and they don't seem to be bothered by it. John points to Jesus and says, "Check it out. Look at that guy." They hear him, and then they do something surprisingly vulnerable. They follow Jesus for a while. They tail him. Not because they have proof, not because they're certain about anything, probably because the exact opposite. Actually, they have no proof. They are not certain of anything. They want to see what happens. They follow because a witness has pointed, and something in them is willing to take a step in that direction. They don't even know what they're looking for. They just know they were told to look. It's easy to romanticize this moment, but for them, it would have felt risky. Following means leaving. It means leaving a place where you were standing. It means stepping away from a teacher you've known. It means moving towards someone you have not yet met. It means allowing curiosity to become movement. And when Jesus turns around and sees them following, he does not say, Do you believe? He doesn't demand a statement of faith. He doesn't test their knowledge. He asks them a question that reaches deeper. The one question that he actually asks more than any other question in all the Gospels. What are you looking for? That question is absolutely unsettling because it refuses to let us hide behind any version of vague religiosity. It assumes that we are, in fact, looking for something. It assumes that there is a longing inside of us. It assumes that we are not neutral in this. What are you looking for? When you first started following, what were you looking for? Assurance? Belonging? Meaning? Relief? Forgiveness? A God who is near? A life that is not exhausted by the same cycles? A way of living that does not turn into fear? Were you looking for a community that doesn't demand perfection before it offers welcome? What are you looking for? And the disciples don't answer his question. They're smart enough not to do that. They don't answer his question. They don't say what they're looking for. They just answer with another question. Where are you staying? Which means a couple of things, if we're being honest. Number one, it means they don't know what they're looking for. And at least they're smart enough to know that they have no clue what it is they're looking for. They're just looking. They're kicking the tires. They have no idea what to expect. But they do know they want to look a little longer. Where are you staying? It's an odd question on the surface to ask somebody where they're staying. They don't ask for a sermon. They don't ask for credentials. They don't ask who he is. They don't ask for a miracle. They ask where he stays, where he abides, where he makes his dwelling. Because what they want, even if they can't articulate it, is not information. They just want proximity. They just want to be there whenever what happens next happens, whatever it is. Almost no expectation, seemingly. They just know that if there's going to be something that happens, it's going to be there, wherever he's at. They want to know where life is happening. They want to know where the light is located in a world that just feels so dim because there's something about this guy they've been tailing for a few hours now that just feels different. And this is where the bottom falls out of what we imagine discipleship to be. We imagine discipleship as something that begins with certainty and then proceeds to relationship. That's the order of it. We decide we're going to follow something, and then it grows into something else. But in this story, it's the exact opposite. The relationship comes first. Staying comes first. Being near comes first. Understanding will come later, and even then it's going to come slowly, and even then they're not really going to figure it all out until long after this teacher of theirs is gone. Understanding is the very last thing that happens for these disciples. It starts with that proximity, and Jesus answers their question with a sentence that is almost disarmingly simple. Come and see. He doesn't pressure them, doesn't persuade them, doesn't trap them in an argument, doesn't demand that they resolve every question before they approach. He just says, come and see. He invites them into his presence. Come and see is not a slogan. It's an opening. It's a doorway to shared spaces. It's an invitation to begin something. And you don't know what. Because it's an invitation to trust. And notice what happens next. They go. They see where he's staying, and they remain with him that day. It's about 4 o'clock in the afternoon. That detail matters. The gospel could have left it out, but it doesn't. It tells you the time, because this is not some idea floating out in the air. This is an actual day in the life of the world. The light is encountered at a particular hour, and discipleship begins in ordinary time, and they remain. It begins with staying. It begins with spending time in the presence of Jesus. It begins with this slow accumulation of trust that happens when you're with someone long enough to see how they speak, how they listen, how they look at people, how they carry themselves. They're sizing him up all day, trying to figure out who he is, what he's about. It begins with learning the contours of life, not from a theory, but from nearness. And then Andrew does something that almost feels inevitable. He goes and finds his brother Simon. He doesn't deliver a polished apologetic. He doesn't bring a carefully structured argument. He says what he can say. We found the Messiah. And then he does the most important thing. He tells Simon, come and see. That's it. That's how the gospel imagines witness. Witness is not manipulation. It's not pressure. It's not Bible study. It's not bringing someone to proximity with the right doctrine. It's about bringing someone into proximity with Jesus. Come and check him out for yourself. See what you think. It's creating space for that encounter to happen. It's trusting that Jesus can do in another person what he has begun to do in you. If it was enough for you to come and see what he was all about, then invite Simon to come along and see what he's all about. You don't have to over-explain him. That's not what the witness does. The witness is not there to tell you everything you need to know about the Christology of Jesus, to explain what it means for him to be born of a Theotokos or anything like that. You don't have to get into these fourth century theological debates. You just got to say, I think this guy's interesting. You should come and check him out for yourself. See what you think. Kick the tires. And you trust that when they show up, that Jesus will take over. And when they see him, they're going to want to stick around and remain until 4 o'clock in the afternoon, just like you did. And Jesus does. Jesus looks at Simon. He doesn't glance, he looks. He sees him, he names him, and then he says, that's not going to do, and gives him a new name. A new identity that hints at a future that Simon just couldn't possibly imagine. You are Simon, but now you're Cephas. This is grace in the form of recognition. Jesus meets people where they are, but he never leaves them there. He sees them truly, and he speaks a future over them. He begins to gather a community, not by sorting the worthy from the unworthy. There's no applications, there's no networking on LinkedIn, there's no prereqs. He's just gathering people who come and see. He welcomes them. He encourages them to stay. And he shapes them. Because God's not gathering by force. God is gathering by an invitation. God gathers by presence. God gathers by saying, in effect, stay close for a while. Let the light be seen from within inside this relationship. If this is how Jesus gathers people, then discipleship cannot be reduced to a series of propositions we agree with. Propositions matter. Truth matters. John himself testifies to the truth, right? That's how this story starts. Truth matters. But the pattern here is clear. Truth is revealed within that relationship. And relationship is sustained through sticking around, staying it out, staying close. There's a kind of faith that tries to leap over this process and jump to the end, as if there's some kind of shortcut we could take. It tries to arrive instantly at clarity, understanding. It wants immediate certainty, immediate resolution, immediate control. It treats questions like threats, uncertainties as failure. It assumes that faith is real, and if it is real, it should be effortless, complete. You got to know all the things. But this story teaches us something much gentler and more honest. Faith never begins with answers. It begins with questions. Faith never begins with certainty, it begins with uncertainty. Faith begins with following. Faith begins with asking, where are you staying? Faith begins with spending time in the presence of Jesus. It begins by sticking around, staying a while. And that means that the life of faith is not a solitary project. Andrew does not remain alone. He goes to find his brother. The first movement outward from this encounter is not a program. There's no rules, there's no speech, there's no etiquette. It's just a relationship. Come and see in practice often looks like come with me. It looks like a shared journey. It looks like bringing someone into the space where you've begun to see the light and have been warmed by it. And here we need to be careful. This is not a call to become recruiters. I don't need you to go out there and start convincing everyone else to sell Cutco knives. I don't need you to join a pyramid scheme. This is not a recruitment speech. If you read the calling of the first disciples and hear that this is a recruitment for a Ponzi scheme, you're doing it wrong. It's not a recruitment. It's not a demand to prove yourself by how many people you can bring. It's a reminder that the grace of God just tends to naturally move along ordinary lines of relationship through friendships and family, through neighbors, through those you share your life with. It moves through people who have been with Jesus long enough to say simply and truthfully, I saw something incredible. You got to see it. Come and see. Not come with me and learn how to think all the right things. Not come with me and join this club for a low membership fee of X. It's never like that. It's always just sharing something incredible with somebody else who you want to share in that incredible thing. What does that look like for us to live that way? It would look like a community shaped by welcome rather than competition, where faith grows through presence, patience. It looks like a people who trust that God has been at work long before certainty showed up, and who make space for curiosity, for questions, for quiet hope. Discipleship would be less about arriving at the right answers and more about learning how to stick around with Christ, who tells us answers we don't like, and to stick around with people who don't always agree with us. It would mean becoming a community where those in the early stages of faith are not hurried, they're not handled, they're not put through a program, they're just held. A place where the wounded are not required to explain themselves, where the cautious are not pressured to perform, where certainty is not treated as some sort of failure if you don't have it. The first disciples begin exactly there. Not with a polished confession, but with a question and the willingness to remain. And that beginning is honored by Christ. Had a doctor's appointment this week. I found a doctor I like, which I know is rare. If you have a doctor you like, you know how that's a rare thing to have. We're pretty close in age. She's got kids about Tristan's age. It's a good match. And she knows what I do for a living, which means that faith doesn't get the religious dialogue from our doctor, but I do. And so I get to hear the religious updates whenever I go see my doctor. It's kind of a checkup for both of us. Except I'm paying her and she doesn't pay me. And she tells me her religious update, that she's decided that she's ready to get baptized at her church. So that's fantastic news. She says, but I'm not going to do it yet. So I asked the question you're all wondering, why not? She said, well, she wants to finish reading through the entire Bible before she gets baptized. And I open my mouth to say the thing that you're all thinking, which is, there's no prereqs, you don't have to do that. But before I can say anything, she quells the comment and says, I know I don't have to. but it's something I want to do. Because for her, what she's trying to articulate, which nobody gets, but what she's trying to articulate is that she just wants to sit there with it all. And it's not that she's not committed already. It's not that she's not already following, but she just wants to take it all in and then jump in. And I get that, right? You can see some of that with this story in John. She has a come and see moment in her life, and she's trying to cherish it for a little bit longer. She knows it's not a prereq. She knows she doesn't have to do it that way, but she just wants to enjoy this time to do that and to make room for it in her life. And part of me wants to rush her and say, no, just go ahead and do it. And part of me wants to say, slow down and enjoy that. And I don't think there's necessarily a right or a wrong either way with this debate. I mean, if you really want to, we can debate this later. I don't think any of us will be happy, but we can do it. And I see in her at least some of what I see in Andrew and in Simon in the story. There's just this initial gut instinct where she just wants to go and see. Not to make up her mind, but just for the awe of it. I think that's what this looks like, at least for her. For you, it looked like something totally different, but I appreciate that instinct she has to just go and see. And when a church lives that way, it begins to echo this invitation at the heart of the gospel. It's in countless small, faithful ways. Its life together says what Jesus said first, come and see. And in doing so, we can participate in the quiet, the patient work by which Christ continues to draw people into a shared life. And this is the most important thing. This is not primarily about what we accomplish, it's about how Christ is present. The light that entered the world continues to draw people toward itself by being encountered. We can't manufacture that. We can only stay close enough to receive it. And when we do, the only thing left to us is to open our lives enough for others to see it. What the disciples asked for was not a lecture. They asked for a place to stick around. And Jesus did not give them an explanation first. He gave them presence. That is still how Christ meets us. In a world that wants quick certainty, God gives us a place to hang out. A place to belong, a place to stay and see. In a life that is so scattered, Christ gives us a point to gather at. And so the invitation to come and see does not end with a conversation on the road. It leads us to a table where Christ and his presence becomes tangible and shared. At this table, we come and see in the way the church has always come and saw. We come and we receive. We come and we remain. We come and stay close enough to be nourished. At this table, there's no demand that we arrive with perfect clarity. He doesn't require that we have settled every question. He just asks again, in effect, what are you looking for? And he answers again, come and find out. Come and see what I'm doing. Come and see what grace tastes like. Come and see what mercy looks like when it takes the form of bread broken and cup shared. Come and see that God's life is given, never earned. The disciples remained with Jesus that day, and here we remain with Jesus now. Not by holding on tightly to our own strength, but by receiving his strength. We remain as a people, not as isolated believers, but as a community, because this meal is not private. It is shared. It is the sign that Christ is gathering us all into one shared life together. And so as we come, Christ looks at us the way he looked at Simon, truly, steadily, without contempt, probably a fair bit of amusement. He knows our given names. He knows our histories, our failures, our hopes, our weariness. And in his mercy, he sees a different future over us. And he calls us what we are becoming rather than what we think we are. He gathers us not only into forgiveness, but into a transformation. So come to this table if you're searching, if you're tired, come. If you're uncertain, if you're hopeful, come and see where Christ is staying. Come and see what it means to stick around and find out. The table is set. Christ is here. The invitation still stands. Come and see. Let's stand and sing.